Well, let's review very quickly what we talked about last night. Now, not all of you were able to be here, and for a while in that traffic on I-5, I thought I wasn't going to be here last night, but we got here. But we'll quickly review. Last night, we told a very old story. It's as old as time, literally as old as human time. And we learned that companionship turns out to be the most important and most powerful human motivation that there is. We went back to Eden and we found that here is this perfect man whom God has just handmade. He has looks, he undoubtedly has personality, he's strong, he's very, very wealthy, he owns the world. No one else will ever be able to say that, although some will try. And he has an excellent job. As we pointed out last night, he's research assistant to the Creator himself. Now, we go through kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus. We go through all of that stuff, and in even the most aggressive graduate programs, a person who goes into that study will take a little window out of the world, like Dr. Booth here, and will specialize in it and develop just a little insight into the world God's made. Adam taxonomically classified every biological organism on earth. So he has everything you could dream of having. Yet he is, while in paradise, still a lonely single. And we learn that only as he found somebody to share paradise with did he really find it meaningful. Now it is evident from the story of Adam that the desire for companionship is more powerful even than our inborn instinct for survival. Because when push came to shove, Adam would go with the girl he loved out into a terrifying unknown rather than to let her go and stay with the certainty of Eden. So, companionship is very, very important. Now, let's quickly go back and review the kind of world God made. We have to do this real quickly because we have more territory to cover this morning. But last night we went through creation week and we noticed that frequently at the end of creation days, the Lord would look at what he had done and he would say, it is good. And we determined that what was good about it was that everything God made, whether it is plant or animal or even the cycle of water flowing through vapor and back into rain and back into streams into the ocean, all of these things move like wheels and everything takes from the system only to enrich with its own creativity and give back as much or more as it took. So in Eden, here are Adam and Eve. And the Lord says you can take anything you want from the system out here, whether it's a molecule of oxygen or a molecule of water, whatever it may be. You enrich what you took, put as much or more back into the system than you got, and the cycle goes on. This is infinity. This can go on forever. There will never be death because you're giving back as much or more than you took. Well, now along comes Lucifer and he suggests to Eve that this equation may be reversible. There may be another way to play it out. Instead of taking from the system and giving back more than you got, why don't you try, Eve, to take from the system and keep a little bit? So Adam and Eve, when they try the process, the experiment of sin, what they decide to do is they will keep a little more than they can give. They want God's vision, they want his perspective on the universe, but they don't have God's capacity to give life and blessing to the whole cosmos. And so the spiral that would have gone outward into infinity now comes inward on them in a constricting spiral. That's the imposter called death. Well, in that, they discover that the perfect marriage is capable of having some stressful moments. And they have their first stress that first night in Eden. But from this whole experiment, we learn that companionship still remains a vital part of the human experience. So, there are a lot of ways people look for companionship. This is one example that I purloined off the wall of an office in Bakersfield, California. Here is a lady who has decided she will play it very careful. She will wait until the perfect man comes along. And there she is. I need to focus that. Now, there is a possibility she may have waited too long. At the least, one can say she may be past her prime. However, on that same office, with a delightful secretary and a delightful sense of humor, I saw another picture of a lady who didn't wait long enough. Here she is in the bathroom washing her hair. She thought she had the perfect man, but she was wrong. For the benefit of the American cassette tapes, what I'm projecting up here is a lady who is deep into shampoo. Her hair is in her eyes. She's reaching out saying, "Honey, hand me the hair dryer." He's handing her a 38 caliber pistol. Now, no doubt. You know, it's kind of strange in our society when a couple may go through the stresses that marriage almost always seems to generate, and survive those and take their marriage to the very pinnacle of what we might call earthly success, there is always some joker that's going to want to shoot them down. And here's my exhibit of that. There are Hillary Clinton and her husband, and some unkind individual has put a caption there that makes their whole accomplishment somewhat meaningless. All right, enough of that. Let's talk this morning about relationships, because they are important. They go right back to Eden, and they are the reason why we're here, and there's no better reason to be here. We have reviewed what happened back in Eden. Let me suggest to you there may be a reason why our relationships are often stressful and sometimes fail, and that is the spiral on the left, the expanding spiral, where you take and get joy out of giving, is God's plan for marriage and plan for life. When we reverse the equation so that the spiral tightens in on ourselves, do you see how, as that thing constricts on a marriage, it can reach a point where there is only room left for one, not for two? There can be the problem, see? So, what we need to do is to figure out, in a practical sense, why it is we're wired to produce that result and what there might be in the Adventist message, in the Christian faith, that can produce a result and an answer for it. Let's first of all talk about relationships and faith. Now, probably all of us have had a similar experience. Let's take it from the guy's perspective, first of all. You get to know a lady, you are successful in getting her to say yes to a proposal for a date. You go out on the date, and you like what you see pretty well. She looks nice, she smells nice, she even laughs at your jokes. You get home, the next morning you get up, you start thinking about it, you say, you know, I would like to do that again. So after what seems like an appropriately decent interval of time, you pick up the phone, you dial her number, she answers the phone, and when you give your name, you hear a tone in her voice that really says, uh-oh, it's him again. Okay? Now, that's never happened to me, you understand. It happened to my friend. And if you believe that, I got some stock to sell you. Well, from the girl's perspective, the same thing can happen. You know, she goes out. He seems to be a pretty decent, caring kind of a guy. She would like to get to know him better, but maybe the phone doesn't ring. Sometimes relationships don't go where we wish they would. And remember now, we're dealing with the most powerful emotion, the most powerful need that the human frame has. Now, over time, as we go through life single, and I can speak to this with perhaps a little better authority than some of my married colleagues, because I was 30 before I got married. I was busy. I was in graduate school. I was in the Navy. I was doing things. And so I was single for longer than a lot of people stay single. And during part of that time, I too was looking for the perfect one to meet, and it's possible as the months and years go by to begin to ask yourself, is it ever going to happen? Ultimately, you have to ask yourself, does the Lord even know or care that I'm here and I'm looking for somebody and I would really like to have a good relationship? And what you're face to face with now is the issue of faith and entrusting your life to the Lord we talk about and sing about on Sabbath mornings. Well, let's try to deal with that issue first. I have a theory that every human being, every living soul in this world, was custom made by God. Custom created. Now, my theory comes from a Hebrew word. Why don't we turn to Genesis 1:26, if you have your Bible. While you're looking it up, I'm going to write a Hebrew word up here on the board. It's very foundational to what I'm going to want to share with you folk. And the Hebrew word is very simple, just three letters. Classical Hebrew shoresh. In the Torah, you won't find anything but consonants. There are no vowels, but let's put them in to make this easier to read. Okay? Couple of ahs. The Hebrew word we're looking for here is the word asah. Ayin, sin, hey. Asah. There are your ahs. Now, it would be transliterated. If you wanted to look it up in Strong's Concordance, you'll probably see something like that, A-W-S-A-W. Not too accurate, but that's the idea. What that word means is a custom-made, hands-on creation. One of a type, absolutely unique. Now, let's take a look at Genesis 1:26, and what do we see there as God is beginning to formulate the human race? Genesis 1:26. And God said, "Let us make man in our image." Now, where it is translated in the English, "let us make man," what they're translating it from is this Hebrew word, asah. Hands in the mud, the potter with his hands in the clay, physically creating something. It is clear from the creation story, God physically handmade Adam. It is even more clear that he physically handmade Eve. Custom creation. Now, I believe that that is the way God makes every one of us. In a very special sense, we are all one-off, unique designs. We're custom creations. Let's do a little looking in the Bible here to verify that. Turn to Job 31:15, if you happen to have a Bible here, and let's read what Job is saying. Now, when you read Job, you've got to be careful. Some of this stuff is read by his comforters. I'm not sure I can buy everything they said. But Job is speaking here. I think it's reasonably accurate. And the 15th verse says, "Did not he that made me in the womb make him? And did not one fashion us in the womb?" Would you like to guess what Hebrew word Job is using when he says make? It's up here on the board. It's asah. Same concept right out of Eden. Job, who is such a prototypical example of somebody close to the Lord that he can be talked about out in the cosmos with the onlooking universe witnessing this, Job has it clear. God custom made me. Well, that's not the only time this concept comes up. Turn over to Jeremiah 1. Jeremiah 1, and you're going to see the same interesting thing happen all over again. And we're looking here for verse 5. "Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee, and before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee." And there the word for "form thee in the belly" or "in the womb" is asah. Same thing occurs in Isaiah 44. Isaiah 44, verse 2. And here Isaiah is in holy vision speaking, giving the words of God. "Thus saith the Lord that made thee and formed thee from the womb, which will help thee." Once again, same Hebrew word crops up there. The Lord made you. Hands-on, custom-made creation. Turn back to Isaiah 43:7, and you see it all over again. "Even everyone that is called by my name, for I have created him for my glory. I have formed him, yea, I have made him." Now, I've spent a little bit of time looking up several scriptures on this because I think it's kind of important for us to appreciate just how unique and special every one of us is. Custom made by God. Now, let's employ a little logic here. If God custom made every one of us, then does it not reasonably follow that God also has a very specific plan for every one of our lives? Does that not logically follow? If he cares enough to make us handmade, he probably has something he wants us to do. I would suggest, I'd go far enough to suggest that his plan for your life could also include a special person he may have custom made for you. Now think it through and the implications get pretty nice, get pretty awesome. Well, in the little book, Christ Object Lessons, page 326, this whole idea is put into a very nicely turned sentence, and it reads as follows. Not more surely is the place prepared for us in the heavenly mansions than is the special place designated on earth where we are to work for God. Did you notice the word special? We are all special people. There's a special design for our lives. Now, Jesus took this concept here in Matthew 6, beginning with the 28th verse. And I want to read it to you from the NIV, because it kind of flows along in a very readable fashion there. And why do you worry about clothes? See how the lilies of the field grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all of these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all of these things will be given to you as well. Now, you notice Jesus says, don't worry about what you're going to eat or drink or wear. Compared with the human need for companionship, those three things are relatively minor. Companionship is the most powerful emotion we have, the need. So therefore, if the Lord will provide the basic necessities of daily life, does it not also make sense he just may have in mind for you a very special person designed for you? Now, there are some people that the Lord has in mind such a special work to do that it may be that his plan for them is to remain single. Their work is so important to him, to the world, and probably to the cosmos, if we could see things clearly, that his will is for them to remain single, and they do that work. There have been some Bible writers who were in that position and so forth. For most of us, however, I think God's ideal is a good relationship with somebody of the opposite sex. Well, is there a possibility God has somebody in mind for you? You realize you're unique, you're one of a kind, God has a special work for you, probably he also has somebody for you, if in fact you will just kind of get self out of the way and give faith a chance to operate. There is a little Jewish joke. I had a real close association with the Jewish people. I began that in law school because so many of my classmates there were Jewish and my roommate was Jewish. And in the Jewish community, there's a little statement, have I got a girl for you? One of my friends, Jerry Levitt, told me the story of a lady at a crowded medical convention ran screaming through the hotel lobby saying, is there a doctor in the house? Is there a doctor in the house? Finally, a young man, very good-looking young doctor, ran up and said, yes, ma'am, I'm a doctor. Can you help me? She says, doctor, if I got a girl for you. Well, it's kind of a cute little story. But the point I'm trying to make is maybe that's the Lord's position. Have I got a girl or have I got a guy for you? I think it just may be the case. Now then, carry that thought a little bit further. Supposing then that not realizing that, we force our future, we don't give faith a chance to operate and let the Lord lead us to the individual that's really designed for us, and we wind up then committing our lives to someone else. Can we be happy? Well, who's to say? Very possibly we might be. You know, happiness isn't only found in one channel. It's possible to be happy in a variety of ways. I suggest we probably will never be quite as happy as we would have been with the one the Lord really meant for us. At the very best, we'll probably, if we ever come to realize this truth, spend a lot of our time in our lives wondering, what did he or she really look like? What did their face look like? What would it have been like to get up every morning and say hello to them in the morning? What would the kids have been like?
How would we have weathered the tough times? And what would the good times have been like? You have to ask these questions. Well, the little sermonette I'm preaching right now is probably one best designed for the very young who are facing this issue, perhaps for the first time, and whom it would probably well behoove to stop and think about issues like this, because they could probably greatly increase the happiness and usefulness of their lives if they did. But might I suggest that you never get too old for faith? And if you find yourself in a position of being single and in a position to properly look for marriage or a lifetime companion, isn't it also possible the Lord has a special person for you still? And if that is so, then maybe in those times when we feel a little bit impatient, wondering if the Lord really knows we're still there and how lonely we're feeling, might be well to learn to exercise that priceless thing called faith. Committing our lives to the Lord, saying, Lord, you know better than I do how to manage my life. I know from my personal experience, as I'll share with you at church, that when I get in there and seize the controls and try to steer my life, I usually make a mess of it. You know, I go places and do things the Lord didn't have really planned for my future. If you back off and give the Lord a chance, He can probably manage your life better than you ever could yourself. And 1,000 worries and possibly a lot of mistakes just disappear like frost before a spring sunrise. So, point number one. Let's learn to trust God with our lives. That is the faith of Jesus. You know, Revelation 14:12 says, here are they that keep the commandments of God and they that have the faith of Jesus. Where was the faith of Jesus most clearly exhibited? On the cross. On the cross, he makes it clear. He speaks into the stream of history the admission that he can no longer see the Father. The Father, as far as he can see, has gone. He's alone. He cannot see the Father, and Ellen White takes it a little bit further in Desire of Ages and says, as far as he can see, he's going to drop into a black hole, and there is no resurrection, there's nothing there but oblivion. The very next thing that happens when he articulates this moment of torment, questioning in his mind, the next thing he articulates is faith. Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. Turns loose of life, and he drops into the unknown, just trusting somewhere there are the Father's arms. That's the faith of Jesus. Well, if he can do that on the cross, can't we do that with an issue like letting him bring us to that very special person? I think we can. Okay, real quickly now, let's go to point number two. Sometimes relationships, even good ones, even the perfect marriage like that of Adam and Eve, don't always go smoothly. Theirs did not, because something happened in Eden. See, to be able to produce paradise, you have to follow the equation the way the Lord set it up. You have to get your joy out of unselfish service, out of giving rather than getting. The problem is that genetically what is handed down to us from Adam and Eve is the reversal of that process. And so we naturally get more joy out of getting things than out of giving things. So that the way, actually, to make a relationship work is to go back and find the paradigm from Eden. Get our joy out of giving. Now, what I've just said here is the core of every wedding sermon, isn't it? And sometimes these things go on along. To the frustrated organist sitting on the sidelines, I speak from experience, waiting for the preacher to get it said so you can get off that hard bench. These sermons seem to sometimes go on a little while, but what they're saying is true. The way to make a marriage work is to get joy out of giving. Well, the problem is we aren't wired to do that. Now, I'm no good at drawing electronic diagrams. I frankly can't understand electronics. But you know, once in a while when the TV goes bad and you try kicking it and beating on it and that doesn't work, you open the book and inside there's a bunch of these diagrams of wires going here and there, you know. They're going off this way and that way. And they come down here. And there are circuits, okay? I think that what happened in Eden was that when Adam and Eve decided that they were going to reverse God's paradigm for the way life should be lived, that something happened in the circuitry and a wire burned in two. I think something happened like that. So that you and I have no longer the capacity to do what we know we should do. There's a gap there, and we can fool ourselves for a lifetime trying to say that it doesn't exist. Now, that, I think, is what Paul is describing here in Romans 7. So let's turn real quickly to Paul's exhibition of his own feelings of frustration as he tries to live the Christian life. Romans 7, verse 12. Wherefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy, just, and good. Now, what he's saying is, this spiral is where I know I need to be. I need to get my pleasure out of giving and of doing right. But then he goes on to verse 14. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. For what I would, that I do not, but what I hate, that I do. Verse 7 or 18. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwells no good thing, for to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I find not. What's Paul's trouble? He is trying to send an electronic signal across a circuit with a gap in it. It just ain't there. Now, all of that helps to explain why sometimes we as Adventists, with our very clear view of the ideals of Adventism and of the relevance of the law of God at the end of time, can get very, very frustrated. There's a missing part in our circuit. Paul very clearly articulates his frustration, but turn to other verses in the Bible and you find that the ideal is there and indeed is something God expects of us. Now let's turn to Revelation 14:12, and what does it say there? Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments. Now you notice John the Revelator does not say here are they that preach the commandments. It says here are they that keep them. He is describing a group of people who are actually doing this rather than this. Now let's turn back to 1 John. We're going to see the same thing all over again. 1 John chapter 3, and let's look at verses 4, 6, and 9. Whoever committeth sin transgresseth also the law, for sin is transgression of the law. That's verse 4. Verse 6, whosoever abideth in him sinneth not. Whosoever sinneth hath not seen him, neither known him. Verse 9, whosoever is born of God doth not commit sin. And that's not the only time he says it. Go back here to 1 John 2, 4. Puts it kind of bluntly. He says, he that saith, I know him, and keepeth not his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. Now, you can go to a lot of places in the Bible and get that same kind of stuff. James, for example, says it. Jesus repeats it many times in the Gospels. So now we seem to have a conflict between what Paul is saying here in Romans 7 and what John is saying in Revelation and in his third epistle, what James, the brother of Jesus, says. Now, when I was back in law school, my professors took fiendish delight in foisting upon the class two cases during the same class session. They were dealing with almost identical facts, almost identical controlling law. They came up with totally different apparent results. One of us poor wretches would be forced onto our feet. The professor there, in full view of the amphitheater of other law students, would say, "Now, Mr. Walton," emphasizing the word Mr. in a condescending tone as if you ever get to be a lawyer, I'll be surprised. He would say, "Harmonize or reconcile the cases. This one says this. This one seems to say this. How are you going to put those two together? How are you going to harmonize what we just read in Revelation and 3 John with what Paul is saying in Romans 7? Paul says, I see it. It's clear. But I can't seem to get it together. How are you going to handle that? While you're thinking about that, let me give a little statement here that Ellen White wrote in her diary one time. She was visiting Sweden. And while in Sweden, in one of her diary entries, she put the following statement, pretty much exegeting 1 John 2:4. She said, there is a spurious experience prevailing now everywhere in regard to the love of Jesus, that we must dwell on the love of Jesus, that faith in Jesus is all we need. But these souls must be instructed that the love of Jesus in the heart will lead to humility of life and obedience to all his commandments. The love of Jesus that goes no farther than the lips will not save any soul. Pretty tough language. How do you reconcile that with Romans 7? Might I suggest that you do so by not quitting with Romans 7? Go on to Romans 8. Romans 8, verse 3. For what the law could not do, in that it was weak through the flesh, weak because of this burned out circuit that we cannot bridge, what the law could not do, and that it was weak through the flesh, God sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, condemned sin in the flesh, that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled where? In us. What's happening here? What I think I see happening is there's about 1,000 volts of human energy and human passion and human need trying to go through that circuit. It's got to get through the right way. The circuit's broken. Jesus says, hang on. I'm going to grab those wires. I'm going to bridge that thing. And I will complete the circuit for you. He held on, folk, and burned his hands in the process. But now, we have a divine bridge over what we couldn't otherwise do. Well, conversion, I think, therefore, is being recreated with the missing wire bridged by Jesus. We don't have any capacity in ourselves to love like this, the way Adam and Eve could have before the fall. Our natural bent is to be selfish, but Jesus bridges that gap. Now, if we don't take advantage of that, let's put ourselves back in a social situation. Our natural outlook on the world is basically, what's in it for me? What pleasure can I get? What problems can I avoid? Put yourself in the situation of a date. It's a first date. What are you thinking all during that evening when you're with the other individual? You're probably thinking, is he or she good for me? Does he or she make me feel good, make me feel needed, make me feel admired? Now, in the ideal setting of a date, you're on the top floor of the tallest building in Seattle in a revolving restaurant, with both parties carefully groomed and on their best behavior, the date may seem like heaven. It may seem pretty nice. But as a lot of divorce lawyers learn, and as I learned doing a lot of divorce work early in my practice, that euphoria has a nasty way of ending after we see the other person in real life. See, so the date is not perhaps a very accurate portrayal of what life will be like with them afterward. And the blunt fact is that in real life, when he makes a lot of noise when he eats, or she doesn't quite get the toast done the way he likes, and these little tensions begin to develop, we don't of ourselves have the capacity to love selflessly. We simply don't have it. Now, in Steps to Christ, it's expressed this way. In his sinless state, man held joyful communion with God. But after sin, he could no longer find joy in holiness, and he sought to hide from the presence of God. Such is still the condition of the unrenewed heart. The sinner could not be happy in God's presence. He would shrink from the companionship of holy angels. Could he be permitted to enter heaven, it would have no joy for him. The spirit of unselfish love that reigns there, every heart responding to the heart of infinite love, would touch no answering chord in his soul. He would be, musicians, a discordant note in the melody of heaven. She goes on to say that heaven would be to him a place of torture. It is no arbitrary degree on the part of God that excludes the wicked from heaven. They are shut out by their own unfitness for its companionship. Don't get the circuit problem fixed, folk, and heaven would not be a place you would particularly enjoy to be. That's essentially what's being said here. Now, listen to it as we close. Education, culture, the exercise of the will, human effort, all have their proper sphere, but here they are powerless. They may produce an outward correctness of behavior. That's the guy and the gal on the date in the top of a revolving restaurant in Seattle. Everything is outwardly correct.
They may produce an outward correctness of behavior, but they cannot change the heart. There must be a power working from within before people can be changed from sin to holiness, and that power is Christ. Now, all this stuff is very familiar prose for anybody who grew up in an Adventist environment. You've heard this 1,000 times. I'm not saying anything you haven't heard many times before. It is so familiar it may sound trite. It may sound like it isn't an answer at all to anything. But here's what we're referring to. We're talking about the way you get the process reversed and the spirals corrected and how you develop genuine joy in giving rather than getting. What I think we're being led to conclude here is that the same process that prepares you for a really successful, happy marriage is identical to the process that prepares you for heaven. Same thing is operating in both instances. Now, I think that we've just discovered, therefore, that finding the right partner is simply having faith in God applied in a very practical way. And getting ready for a successful marriage is the same precise process as getting ready for heaven itself. Number one, we realize that God has custom made every one of us and has a specific plan for our lives. Number two, from that it logically flows that He probably has somebody very special out there waiting for us if we'll get out of the way and let Him get us together. Number three, we have to have absolute acceptance of His plan, even when maybe momentarily we get a little bit impatient or frustrated or wonder where things are leading. And finally, we have to have acceptance of the character He has in mind for us, so when that right person comes along, we're going to make a success of it. And for that, we need Jesus. And so I think here, folks, is where the cross enters in. There's this gap in our souls, and the cross bridges it. And in a practical way, that's what makes life worth living.
You've been listening to Attorney Lewis Walton, American Cassette Ministries guest speaker. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. If you have been blessed by this message and other American Cassette Ministry cassettes, please take a moment just now and write to us. We'd love to hear how this ministry has helped you in your spiritual journey. International copyright 1995, American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. Christian ethics prohibit reproduction in any form. For additional cassettes by Attorney Walton or other American Cassette Ministry speakers, or for a free catalog of the finest sermons, music cassettes, CDs, and videos, please place your order as follows. To order toll-free in the United States and Canada, dial 1-800-233-4450. For fax orders, dial 717-652-9050. For international orders, dial 717-652-7000. Or you may write to American Cassette Ministries, Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 17108 in the United States of America. Celebrating 20 years of service to the Seventh-day Adventist Church, American Cassette Ministries requests your continued prayers and financial support as we strive to provide you with balanced, powerful messages that will help you in your preparation to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.